Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is New Books in Psychology, and I'm your host, Eugenio Duarte, in New York. Today, we're crossing over into the area of anthropology and talking about childhood and how it's conceived in societies across the globe. Anthropologist David Lancey addresses this issue in his book, The Anthropology of Childhood, Cherubs, Chattel, Changelings, which is now in its second edition, published in 2015 by Cambridge University Press. David F. Lancey is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at Utah State University and author and editor of several books on childhood and culture, including Cross-Cultural Studies in Cognition and Mathematics, published in 1983, Playing on the Mother Ground, Cultural Routines for Children's Learning, published in 1996, Studying Children in Schools, published in 2001, and The Anthropology of Learning in Childhood, published in 2010. David, so glad to have you on the show. Welcome.
Very happy to join you.
So I want to start with your most recent book, The Anthropology of Childhood, Cherubs, Chattel, Changelings. And I want to start with the title. What does it mean?
Well, the title has two parts, obviously. The first part is designed to convey the idea that this is an anthropological study of childhood to distinguish it from any number of other studies or perspectives on childhood. So this is the first of its kind. And if you ask the average anthropologist, they might, about the anthropology of childhood, or at least before this book came out, they might have said, what? Because the anthropology of childhood has not been a prominent topic. It now is, not entirely as a result of my efforts, but it was a minor topic in anthropology. And, but I think I was able to demonstrate in the book to a wider audience, especially among anthropologists, that it was worth looking at what anthropologists had found out about children. The second part of the title is defines kind of the signposts in this literature. And that is that I wanted to get across the idea that different cultures view childhood in very, very different ways, or view children in very, very different ways across cultures. And in particular, that our culture was a bit of an outlier, that the many aspects of the way we raise children, the way we look at them, their lives are really quite distinctive when compared to just about everybody else. And so cherubs are children, I consider those to be typical of the children in our society, which are really, really important. They are at the apex of, let's say, a hierarchy. We devote so much attention and money to them. In the cultures the anthropologists study, it's quite the reverse. Children aren't that very, very important. And one of the reasons they're not very important is because they're a burden. They don't do much. They don't make much of a contribution. They don't know very much. So I contrast our culture, which I call a neontocracy, with the rest of the world, which traditional societies, historical societies, which I call a gerontocracy, where the oldest people, even the ancestors, sit on top of this hierarchy and children are pretty much at the bottom. Chattel, one of the most common ways to view children is as chattel, that is, as property, as future workers, as resources to be utilized as soon as they are able to make a contribution. For example, adoption and the circulation of children in the past was extremely common. And it was done as much as anything else because children were seen as labor, household helpers or future helpers, and they were moved around among family members, grandparents, and so on as needed. Then you have changelings. Changelings is a term that describes the view of children, the view of infants in particular, that people are very ambivalent about infants. Infants represent a great threat to their mothers and even to the community, to the family. I know that from our perspective, that sounds really, really strange, but when you consider the very high child mortality rates, when you consider the enormously high fatality of mothers in childbirth that would have been typical until very recently, you can begin to get into the idea that infants are really as much of a threat as anything else. They could be changelings, meaning that they are not as they appear. That is, they're not pure innocent babies, but they could have some malevolence. And typically, when an infant cries a great deal, or looks strange, or behaves in any sort of strange manner, or is very demanding, they begin to think, "Oh, this is not a human being. This is some, you know, the gremlins have placed their offspring. They've switched like a cuckoo, switched the babies, and you've ended up with a child that is not really yours." And so you might put that child in a situation where they will be, in effect, traded back till you get your own child. But of course, what happens in most cases, changelings are placed in a situation which they cannot survive from. They're placed out in the wilderness overnight or something like that. So that's the title, in too many words, probably. that's what the title represents.
Well, and that's a great introduction to the ideas that you cover in the book. But of course, you may not be surprised to hear me say this. Our listeners are, I'm assuming, predominantly of the Western world, and many of them might be hearing this and having negative reactions to some of the things that you said about how children can be viewed as changelings or as chattel. So what is it that you are trying to accomplish by sharing with a Western audience all these ideas and all these practices around childhood from other cultures? Why do you think it's important for us to know how other cultures, other societies handle and think about children?
Well, you can come at that from a number of different angles. You can come at it from a scientific, theoretical angle, or you can come at it from a pragmatic angle. So if we start with a scientific perspective, the study of childhood, the study of child development of children is pretty much owned by psychology, owned by developmental psychology. And when you pick up a typical child development, child psychology textbook, there are assertions made from that research that are designed to speak to childhood universally. That is, the research is undertaken, thousands of studies every week, dozens and dozens of journals. Most of that research is based on a false foundation, because it's based on assumptions we make about children in our own culture. That is, it is culture bound. By definition, is ethnocentric. And our children make really, really bad subjects, actually, for research about children in the broad sense, because our approach to raising them the way they view them is so atypical. So part of what I was trying to do was to offer a corrective to prevailing views. And there are certain areas where the research basis for research in the West is really pretty far from what we now understand is much more typical ways of looking at children elsewhere. The pragmatic side of it has to do with contemporary child rearing. So I don't address that issue so much in the book, actually, because my main goal with the book is really to set down a theory of childhood based not primarily in psychology, but in anthropology. So it's an academic book, but the pragmatic part of it arises because I've started to, in effect, take many of those ideas in the book and reshape them, if you will, into messages to parents. Some years ago, I started a blog on the Psychology Today website called Benign Neglect. And basically, I do blog posts that take from my book, The Anthropology of Childhood, some of these ideas and address and really try to answer your question, why should we care? You know, why would people in the West care? And then even more recently, I've compiled those blog posts into a book. So this is the next book that will be coming out in June. It's called Raising Children, Surprising Insights from Other Cultures. So this is my attempt now. Back through all that academic literature from anthropology and try to mine it for ideas about contemporary child rearing.
So it seems like your book, you're not just putting Western ideas side by side with non-Western ideas in a neutral sort of way. It kind of sounds like you're actually saying that the way we do things in the West are atypical, that we're sort of the ones that are not normal. Is that so? And if that's the case, I'm wondering if you could even give us an example that illustrates a way in which we do things very differently from the rest of the world.
Right. Okay. So just off the top of my head, we think that corporal punishment is very, very harmful and damaging to children, strict discipline. Majority of the world's cultures don't think that way at all. There is a significant minority who would agree with us that see that as harmful to children. But the vast majority, if anything, is the other way around. The standard view of things is that children, for their own good, sometimes need disciplining, including corporal punishment. And that's really, in a way, that particular issue, that particular contrast is sort of a tip of the iceberg. And in that, in addition to things like corporal punishment, most of the world thinks that children should work, they should do chores, they should help out. Most of the world thinks that children should have good manners, should defer to adults, not interrupt conversations. So there's a cluster of views about children and about their resiliency, their toughness, I wrote a paper in Published in Child Development called Playing with Knives. And I found many, many cultures that do not discourage children from playing with sharp knives, maybe even give them to them. And basically what people say when the anthropologist challenges them and says, isn't that dangerous? Is, well, it's far more dangerous to deny them the opportunity to learn freely and autonomously and through their own self-initiative. So if you don't let them give them free rein, they will be handicapped. So there are a whole variety of ways in which I think we've become overprotective of children. We overmanage. I mean, again, looking from the perspective of the anthropology of childhood. And now it's like the visitor from Mars phenomenon. So supposing I had spent all my time looking at children in other cultures around the world, or could time travel back to ancient Rome and so on. And then I landed in our society, contemporary America in particular, and I would become the anthropologist studying that. I would have all these exclamation marks. I would say, oh my gosh, you know, all, I mean, it would seem really, really strange to me. And that's because we use a term like overprotection, overmanagement, and so on. Essentially, we're saying, look, that's not how children used to grow up. Even in my own childhood, I mean, I have no trouble at all mining my own childhood. I'm 72 years old. So my childhood was drastically different in many, many ways, even though I was middle class. It was still drastically different in many, many ways from my neighborhood, the kids in my neighborhood. I mean, for example, I'm sitting here in my office looking out on a very snowy hillside, and it's a great place for sledding, okay? And what I see happening is I look out my office on a weekend, I see van after car after pickup truck coming, bringing children and their sleds to do some sledding here where the parents are supervising. And this is a very local park, so I would guess that the majority of the parents are coming from 4 or 5 blocks away at most. The other day, I know it was a kind of a snowy day, and I noticed at the stop sign, bottom of my street, two or three vans sitting at the stop sign idling. And I wonder, what are they doing? Well, they're there to pick up their kids getting off the school bus because their poor little darlings might be cold and wet by the time they walk 2-3 blocks home.
And from your tone, it sounds like you think this is kind of crazy.
It's crazy. It's insane. Absolutely.
But if you don't mind, I want to go back to the topic of corporal punishment, because not only is it a charged one, right, but I think it's a good opportunity to illustrate see if we can understand the vast differences between cultures, because I'm pretty sure that many people heard your remarks on that and just cannot wrap their mind around any way of legitimizing something like corporal punishment. But right. let's try to see if we can understand here. So in cultures where, and it sounds like you're saying that's most of them, in cultures where corporal punishment against children is legitimate and normal, why is that so? And why are they not concerned about the negative impact of corporal punishment on their children the way that we are, to the extent that we prohibit it?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let me take the second part of your question, which is why aren't they concerned about the negative effects? They're not concerned because they don't believe there are any negative effects, okay? They don't. Punishing children, corporal punishment of children, is observed with enormous frequency by anthropologists who are living in with these people, with different cultures. They see it with great frequency. What they don't see is anything that they would regard as actually damaging to the child. Children bounce back very quickly. They're not really harmed physically in any evident way. They are, they're at 10 minutes after being smacked, they may be up playing again, so they bounce back. There's a great deal of resiliency. This is not, I'm not advocating for a return to the past in our society with respect to corporal punishment. What I'm saying is that it, like a lot of things that we are now taboo in our society, it's probably not nearly as harmful to children as we think it is, number one. Number two, when you see that corporal punishment is so universal, so widespread, you have to start thinking, well, if it's this common, maybe this is a tactic that actually works, okay? That is, it isn't people are not using it because they're mean or they don't like their children. They're using it because it's a time saver, if you will. It's much harder as a parent, much, much more difficult. You have to invest far more time controlling children's behavior by reasoning with them, by engaging them in a conversation. It is far more difficult and challenging than just giving a kid a SWAT, okay, if you want them to stop doing something. And in the rest of the world, people work very, very hard. You know, in these traditional cultures, we use the term subsistence, farming or foraging, hunting and gathering. People are working very hard. Their view of children is that they need to raise them in a way, they need to care for them in a way in which they are largely autonomous. They take care of themselves. And they don't have a lot of time, and they don't think it's important to spend a lot of time carefully cultivating in children the ability to reason about their behavior, the ability to have a conversation with the adult about the child's behavior. So basically, when you say, well, parents have to control the behavior of their children because children are not born angels. And okay, and how do you do that? Well, I'm just saying, in our society, we've made it really hard for ourselves because we've said this is how you do it. And if parents fall down on the job, as they sometimes do, I think we should be somewhat fall down on the job and let's say in anger or in not in disgust or whatever, whack their kids. I think we should not necessarily treat that as a capital offense. I guess I would look upon it kindly.
But do anthropologists have ways of studying or empirically demonstrating that, in fact, things like corporal punishment or other such practices don't have negative effects on children? Is there a way of scientifically backing that?
Here's the kind of data if you're reading in this literature, and to give you some idea of what's in my book, what I'm drawing on, I have a corpus of material that I've gathered over about 15 years now. A corpus of material, it's in English, French, German, some in Japanese, that runs into 25, 30,000 pages of notes of material extracted from hundreds and hundreds of these accounts, many of them unpublished, doctoral dissertations, master's theses, and so on. And I've mined these, I've organized them and mined them and gone through again and again and again. And I can tell you several things from that. First of all, frequently anthropologists note corporal punishment. Secondly, they frequently note, with some surprise, exclamation mark, that there doesn't appear to be any harm or any problem to those children. Thirdly, this is a little less frequent, only because anthropologists didn't think to ask the question. But when anthropologists talk to adults about their experiences as children and whether or not they were punished, whether they were beaten on occasion, and what did they think about that? Was that something that was caused them later harm? Universally, parents will say, oh, no problem at all. That's what you're supposed to do. And they'll express gratitude to their parents for keeping them on the straight and narrow path, so to speak.
So one of the things that I want to go back to is the difference between a neontocracy and a gerontocracy, because it seems like that's the core paradigm that might mm-hmm. be operative and explain a lot of the differences that we see between societies. Can you tell us what is a neontocracy? What is a gerontocracy?
Okay. All right. Yes. Good. Let me start with the gerontocracy because that's really what the book is more about. And how do we get here? Well, let me start with a concrete example from the book of how a gerontocracy plays out in terms of how individuals, when they're deceased, how are they buried? How are they interred? Okay, this seems a little strange to start with this, but it's so clear in these examples. okay, many societies have in effect ideas about burial. So if you have somebody who's very old and very important, they get a really fancy burial. They get, there's a funerary ceremony. They're buried in a privileged location. They may have grave goods buried with them and so on. This would be someone near the apex of the social hierarchy in that community. One level above that person usually would be considered ancestors. And ancestors often are maintained as shrines to the ancestors, either people that have died and not recently, but in the past. And I visited some of these shrines all around the world, and they're, you know, essentially how the shrine is organized varies, but the idea is the same, that you continue to make offerings and make blessings and make requests of your long dead ancestors, and a shrine is maintained. That's at the very apex. Next are these, as I said, very important men, women who've passed on. They're buried in the ceremony. Many, many societies then, as we drop down the age hierarchy, many, many societies do have no formal interment at all, no funeral at all for a child under 10. Child under 10 may not even be considered fully a person yet. Comments are made, will be made in terms of this hierarchy about the fact that children don't know how to do much, or they can't accomplish very much. They haven't married. They don't have a home. They haven't born children. These are all the things that make you an important person. Okay. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't achieved those, then you will not be mourned. You will not be considered very much. When you get to younger children, babies and 1, 2, 3 years old, they may not be buried in the cemetery at all, or whatever the designated burial ground is. They may not be married there at all. They may be buried in the walls of a home, in the floor of a house, just very casually and without ceremony, without grave goods, without any attention. An exception would be, let's say, in ancient Egypt or ancient Rome, a very high-ranking family might have a more formal interment. But there won't be a funeral. And if the mother appears to be weeping, crying, unhappy, then she will be chastised by other women, her mother, her sisters. And they will tell her more or less, stop this. Don't waste time on a child that is now gone. Prepare your mind, prepare yourself to have another one.
But what is the psychology or the logic underlying this?
What is the logic underlying this?
Or the psychology?
What is the psych? Well, because the idea is that this child was not yet a person. Their loss is not nearly as great as somebody older. You see, it has to do with individual worth, and because a child is totally dependent on others, and the child cannot make any contribution to anyone else, doesn't really help out in any way, then they're worth this much less. I mean, if you look at historical records during the Middle Ages, for example, when they had something called Wehrgeld or blood money, so if there were when people were killed in a raid or in inter-village fighting and so on, and one group if you were guilty of killing another person from another group and you wanted to expiate that and not lead to greater hostilities, you would have to pay money to the family of the person that you killed. And so there was a specific price. Higher prices for men than women, much higher prices for mature women, childbearing age women, than for girls, and almost nothing for babies. So it was a pittance. And so that was another way in which this hierarchy was reflected. Children are at the bottom of the heap in a gerontocracy. And the only way they can move up the hierarchy is through good deeds, through helping out, through contributions to others, and taking on greater and greater responsibility, herding the flock, herding cattle, working in the garden, fishing, hunting, bringing food into the family, their status will rise gradually. Now, if you go to the neontocracy, it's the other way around. That is, children are from birth right at the top. Right at the top. We spend billions of dollars every year on extreme medical treatment for infants, preterm infants, or infants that are born with difficulties. We lavish an enormous amount of money on there. An infant has their own room in the house from the get-go, whereas in the traditional village, the child sleeps with its mother and sleeps with its family. And really not till they're an adult would they have any space really to claim as their own, whereas we start out before they're even born. We allocate space. We allocate furniture. We allocate special foods. We have there are toys. We may re-engineer our house to make it childproof. The list of things that we do for our children, either out of anxiety or out of love or out of feeling that this is now what everybody does, would be so strange again to the folks that anthropologists typically study. They wouldn't understand it. It wouldn't make any sense to them.
You know, I'm wondering about whether you've actually ever traveled to such societies and interacted with people. And I'm wondering if you've ever shared with them how we do things and what they think about how we do things.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely done that. I'll give you one kind of shocking example of this sort of culture clash thing. When I was working in Papua New Guinea, I had a comparative research project where I was collecting data at multiple sites throughout the country in different kinds of cultures. So Papua New Guinea is a kind of human laboratory because there are so many different lifestyles, different kinds of subsistence systems that you find within that one country. This particular site that I've gone back to repeatedly was a small, tiny coral sand key at the very northern border of New Guinea, out in the ocean, so to speak. And on one occasion, I took my family there. At that time, my younger daughter was an infant. She was about 5 months. And my older daughter was about a year and a half, I guess, at that point in time. Well, we get to this island and their mother, we took us 3 hours on an outrigger canoe to get out there. And we get there and as we're unloading the outrigger canoe, we were surrounded by folks, people, very excitedly. And the two girls, my two daughters, were literally whisked away. Which freaked out my wife, needless to say. And so for the 4 or 5 days that we were living on the sand key, my younger daughter was brought to her mother only when she needed to nurse. Otherwise, the two kids were completely absorbed into the village. For hours on end, we might not see them. And so this was obviously what the takeaway message from this instance, and which is echoed throughout the literature, is mothers aren't that important in the rearing of their children. That child care, child rearing is a community affair. You heard the expression, it takes a village. One manifestation of that saying, one way to understand that saying is that everybody pitches it, not everybody, but a group pitches in. There's a certain number of people. Typically an older sister will be charged with the responsibility of looking after younger siblings. Often a grandmother. spends her time caring for other children. I have these wonderful pictures of my daughter Sonia, who, as I said, is about 4 or 5 months old, and she's sitting in the lap of this old granny woman, this old crone, and they're just happy as clams. I mean, you'd look like belong to the same family or something. And likewise, my older daughter playing with the children and being treated just like she was the younger sibling of some of the kids that were there. And they looked after her and played with her and integrated her completely into the thing. My wife just had to go with it, live with it and figure out herself what she was going to do and start helping out with chores and so on and so forth. So that's one example, but I could give you more examples of the sort of experience that I would have that would show this conflict. But also, I've also talked to parents. I mean, when my first field work was in Liberia in a remote village there, and I would talk to parents not directly. I wouldn't necessarily challenge them. I would just simply ask much more open-ended questions, which are typical of anthropology, simply saying, well, tell me about good kids, tell me about bad kids, how does a kid turn out good, and how does a kid turn out bad? And bear in mind, when I ask a question like this, I'm using the native, and I'm using terms, I've spent enough time there, I've eavesdropped on conversations to know that if I use the term good or bad, they would know what I'm talking about.
So, David, let's stay with Papua New Guinea. How do they conceive of the role of the father?
Oh, very nice. I'm glad you brought that up. Actually, the father is not expected to be part of the picture almost at all. Okay? There are exceptions, really interesting exceptions. The generally speaking, very small, highly egalitarian forager societies, such as the Pygmies in Central Africa, for example, and there are a few others scattered around, particularly Africa, very few. In those societies, because they're so highly egalitarian, the fathers are involved with childcare. They join this community of caretakers I've been speaking about. That is, when studies have been carefully done about who spends time caring for infants and children, most often it's older siblings. Second, most often is grandparents. Most of the cultures studied by anthropologists, fathers are not involved at all. But in these foraging societies, they may be involved, but still not. They don't loom very large. They're not very important in this picture. Actually, in many societies that go much further in terms of not just the fathers aren't involved, but where they would have some rationale in effect that in a way prohibits their various views that would actually prohibit a father interacting with their child. And those prohibitions, the rationale, if you will, vary for different reasons, but largely have to do with it would diminish the father's standing. It's women's work, and so fathers shouldn't be involved.
So, you have children, and I know that you teach as well. So you interact a lot with young people, and so I'm wondering, I'm wondering if you think that there are any kind of problems that you see in society among young people, such as something like failure to thrive, that you think, I'm wondering if you think that some of the things that young people struggle with today might be attributable to the, atypical way that we do things here. And if you think that there are things from other cultures that we should be mimicking or learning from.
Oh, absolutely. As I mentioned before, I've got this new book coming out, which is a complement to the anthropology of childhood, because I take a much more critical stance, if you will, and without necessarily it being an advice manual. What I do is I try to run through what are some of the major contrastive areas. For example, this is where I think we're in big trouble in how we do things. in from psychology, from developmental psychology, originally Harriet Rheingold did a study looking at children in the age range of 12 to 18 months. Created a simulation of an adult trying to do something, trying to solve a problem, trying to fix something or complete something or do something. The children universally in these studies volunteer to help out. And in many cases, they're actually helpful, and they've tried to sort of set up play alternatives. That is, they try to seduce children away from being helpful to play with toys or new toys. And kids are really, really insistent on helping out. And of course, in our studies in anthropology, this is one of the most common and remarkable things to see: toddlers already helping out, carrying little basins of water, feeding animals, bringing firewood, going into the forest with their family, collecting berries when they have their own little baskets. And this is just so commonplace, absolutely the norm, that children from a very, very early age pitch in, help out, and develop a real sense of altruism, pro-social behavior, and share, food sharing, resource sharing. This is typical. This is how they're raised. In our society, what's happened, I think, we don't see that. Study after study shows that contemporary middle-class children in the West they're absolute parasites in their families. They don't even keep their own rooms tidy and put away their own stuff, do their own laundry. And this is such a frequent complaint of parents. And I think what's happened is that children in our society start to volunteer. They volunteer. They want to help out. But we're so afraid of them getting hurt. We're so afraid, or we realize that allowing them to help in the kitchen, for example, may be more work, make more work for us. But the point is we deny them opportunities to be helpful because we say, oh, you hurt yourself or you make a mess or that's mommy's job or no, do your homework. And we find all sorts of excuses why they should not help out. And then we think, okay, you're getting old enough now. You should begin to help out, say 7, 6, 7, 8 years old. By which time it's too late. What happens is that drive to be helpful is extinguished. And instead, children develop this notion that they're getting a free ride. They're getting a free ride, and so I think this is one area of really, really serious concern. I've written a blog post talking about the phenomenon of failure to launch, and I said I think it starts in early childhood because we don't let our children. When they venture to take on responsibilities, we deny them those opportunities. And I think the problem starts there, and there are corollary issues later.
And staying with young people, when you teach these ideas to your students, assuming again that these are students raised in the Western world, how do they respond? What do they think?
Oh, they love it. My anthropology of childhood classes, I have a lot of fun with that. I mean, I have a lot of fun with that because students, right, there's so much culture shock throughout the class. And what I do with the class is I have about a dozen video clips. So the videos, and I start the class off. That was one of the first things I do is I show these video clips that show, for example, a 2.5-year-old child with a machete chopping away at a piece of palm, the trunk of a palm, just whacking away. And in the same film, you'll watch an even younger child, toddler, walking behind this child that's chopping away. And the child has got this machete over its head. So, I mean, there's actually this moment when the tip of this machete is only inches from an even younger child. So I have films like that, showing children doing chores, showing films that illustrate the gerontocracy system, and so on and so forth. So I basically force the culture shock on them right away. And I think what ultimately one of the reasons that class is successful, and I think one of the reasons the book has been successful, The Anthropology of Childhood, has actually reached a much larger audience than I originally intended. One of the reasons it's successful is it helps people understand our culture better. So once you step outside our culture and you look at things from the point of view of these other cultures, then you relook at our culture, I think there's some enlightenment. There's some aha feelings that emerge because it allows us to become less ethnocentric.
Well, David, this has been a very enlightening conversation. I feel like I've learned so much and there's so much more to talk about. But before we go, remind us of the name of your upcoming book and do you know when we can expect it?
Yes, thank you very much for asking that. It will be out in June. It will be published by Cambridge University Press, the same press that published Anthropology of Childhood. And it's called simply Raising Children, Surprising Insights from Other Cultures.
I think we're all going to very much look forward to that. Again, thank you for coming on the show and for talking to us.
All right. Very much. I appreciate the invitation.
That was my interview with David Lancey, author of the book, The Anthropology of Childhood, Cherubs, Chattel, Changelings, in its second edition, published by Cambridge University Press. This is Eugenio Duarte for New Books in Psychology. Don't forget to tell me what you think by going to my website, www.eugenioduartephd.com, and clicking on the blog and podcast tab to find this episode and leave a comment. Until next time, have a great week.